Missoula police identify a trans imp found dead in the snow. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the first Democrat to officially file for Montana's U.S. House seat. And in our feature story, news director Sally Mock talks with friends and colleagues of Missoulian reporter Betsy Cohen, who died earlier this week of breast cancer. Missoula County authorities have released the name of a disabled transient whose body was found in the snow near the railroad tracks in Missoula. Detective Paige Pavilon says the body of 34-year-old Keith William Byington was found shortly before noon yesterday. Missoula Police Detective Travis Welsh says Byington had been dead for several days when a Montana Rail Link employee spotted his body as the snow from a recent storm began to melt. Welsh tells KECI-TV that evidence recovered at the scene indicates foul play may have been involved. An autopsy is planned and the case is still under investigation.
And in other news from around the state, police in Kalispell have arrested a suspect for the break-in and vandalism at the Kalispell clinic that provides abortions. Officers say 24-year-old Zachary Klunt of Columbia Falls was arrested on suspicion of burglary and carrying a concealed weapon at about 6 last night by police responding to another reported break-in. Police say he could be charged with felony criminal mischief, attempted burglary, and theft for the damage at All Families Healthcare, which was discovered yesterday morning when a receptionist arrived at work. Klunt is being held in the Flathead County Jail. Physician assistant Susan Cahill says she's angry that people are trying to prevent her from performing a legal procedure.
Flathead County officials say a Martin City man accidentally shot and killed himself over the weekend. Detective Dick Sines says 37-year-old Edward Schramm was examining a rifle on Sunday when it accidentally discharged and hit him in the face. The Daily Interlake reports a friend witnessed the shooting and reported it at about 11:15 a.m. Sign says no foul play is suspected.
Amtrak is busing its Empire Builder passengers between stations in Whitefish and Shelby due to the threat of avalanches on Marias Pass. Amtrak spokesman Mark Magliari said today that passengers will ride buses between the two stops until at least Saturday, while the empty train will travel over the pass. Magliari tells the Flathead Beacon that BNSF Railway rules don't allow loaded passenger trains to run if there has been a recent slide. The rail line was closed late Sunday night between Essex and Marias Pass after an avalanche covered the tracks with 7 feet of snow and debris.
Missoula public school officials say at this point, cases of pertussis found in Hellgate High School is still limited to 3 students. These 3 cases of whooping cough were found in the last week at the school. Missoula Public Schools Communication and Technology Director Hatton Littman says county health workers are interviewing further students considered to be at risk and identifying students who should receive a doctor's evaluation.
If the Missoula City County Health Department has not contacted you, that means that your student is not considered to be at risk. And they will really lead the investigation and contact families that they recommend need to visit a doctor.
If students are exhibiting symptoms of pertussis, such as coughing, fever, or a runny nose, Littman recommends those students visit the school nurse or contact the City County Health Department at 406-258-4770. Littman says some other isolated cases of whooping cough were found last fall at Sentinel High School and Seeley Swan High School.
An arbitration panel has determined the Salish and Kootenai tribes would have to pay nearly $18.3 million to acquire a northwestern Montana hydroelectric dam from PPL Montana. Energy Keepers Incorporated, a tribally owned corporation, said today the tribes will notify the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission of their intent to acquire the Kerr project southwest of Polson in September 2015. In 1985, FERC issued the dam's operating license to both Montana Power and the tribes to settle a contested proceeding. Montana Power was to operate the project for at least 30 years, after which the tribes would have the option to buy. PPL Montana, which purchased the dam from Montana Power, said the purchase price should be $49.4 million. The tribes countered it should be $14.7 million. KERAM in Polson reports an arbitration panel set the price of $18.3 million on Monday.
A Blackfeet tribal member carrying a bison heart in a plastic bag was stopped outside Governor Steve Bullock's office in the Montana Capitol yesterday. Police at the Capitol prevented James St. Goddard from entering the office of the governor, who was not there at the time. St. Goddard says he was protesting the killing of pregnant bison by the Nez Perce tribe from Idaho. he was allowed to bring the heart into a meeting with the director of the governor's office of Indian Affairs. St. Goddard tells the Independent Record that hunting bison this time of year, when females are carrying fully developed fetuses, violates the Blackfeet's and other tribes' reverence for the animals. The Nez Perce is one of three tribes with bison hunting rights outside of Yellowstone National Park.
Montana's largest mining company racked up a $270 million net loss last year after writing down the value of two foreign properties and putting more focus on its precious metal mines in the Beartooth Mountains. Stillwater Mining Company said in its recently released annual report that it expects to ramp up capital spending for 2014 by as much as $26 million. Much of that will go into new areas under development at its mines near Nye and East Boulder. The company added 109 jobs last year and has about 1,770 employees. It was seeking to expand into Canada and Argentina until disgruntled investors joined by former Governor Brian Schweitzer staged a corporate board takeover last year. Stillwater has since taken $461 million in lost revenue charges on its foreign acquisitions.
The open race for Montana's lone congressional seat officially has its first Democratic candidate. John Lewis left his job as Senator Max Baucus' state director last year to begin his campaign. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Lewis filed today with the Secretary of State.
When the Secretary of State's office knows kids are stopping by, staff bring out a little something special.
We have some future voter stickers for you guys.
Little stickers reading "Future Voter," and then a little maze for them to follow on paper. This time, it's candidate John Lewis's young son and daughter tracing their way through the lines, because Dad is filing for office. He's the only Democrat running in the race so far to take over the House seat currently held by Republican Steve Daines. Daines is running for U.S. Senate. While Lewis is the only Democrat, there are five Republican candidates currently in the mix. That could be an advantage or disadvantage for Lewis. On one hand, whoever wins the Republican nomination will have to spend a lot more money, resources, and energy to make it to the general election. But on the other, those Republicans will be able to hone their message through the primary campaign. Possibly the winner will be a stronger contender. Lewis says he's trying not to think about that stuff.
I know that we're going to work very hard, as we have, traveling all 56 counties, getting to over 120 communities, and talking to people about the solutions.
When he mentions traveling to all 56 counties, he's talking about a project he did while working for Senator Max Baucus' office in 2011. Opponents paint that accomplishment in a different light. A website by the National Republican Congressional Committee accuses Lewis of laying the groundwork for his campaign by visiting every county in Montana on the taxpayer's dime. Now, this website, again from the Republican Congressional Committee, has the somewhat misleading title of JohnLewisForCongress.com. CNN reports the NRCC has propped up at least 15 of these fake Democratic campaign websites in House races across the country. In fact, when you search John Lewis Congress on Google, this NRCC site is the first one that comes up.
There are going to be efforts to try to define me as something I'm not, but Montanans will see right through that, and they'll know what I stand for.
Lewis lists some of his priorities as fighting to protect the state's agriculture industry, expanding access to education, and defending the Second Amendment. His former boss, Senator Baucus, was one of the chief architects of the Federal Affordable Care Act. Opponents also knock Lewis for those ties. Obamacare remains unpopular in Montana. Lewis has said the law isn't perfect, but that it has done a lot of positive things. For his own strategy, his campaign promises to be, quote, the most advanced in the history of Montana. The campaign will include widespread social media and other online efforts. He had about $320,000 on hand for the race at the beginning of this year, the last required reporting period. He says all that does not make up for getting out and talking to people.
It still comes down to getting around the state, shaking hands. People want to know you. People want to see you in their communities, and that's what we're doing.
Lewis included his candidate filing as part of a seven-city tour of the state this week. Filing for state and federal races in Montana closes next Monday, March 10th. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A trial is underway in Great Falls in the case of a consultant charged with defrauding a former Blackfeet youth program that received federal funding. U.S. Attorney Carl Rostad told jurors yesterday that prosecutors would present a, quote, litany of evidence about fraud, waste, and abuse in the program. Prosecutors allege $475,000 of the project's money went to a business owned by Gary Conti, who served as its monitoring consultant. Conti is charged with kicking back more than $230,000 of that money to accounts controlled by project leaders Francis Onstad and Delisle Shani Ogier between 2008 and 2011. The Great Falls Tribune reports defense attorney Josh Van de Wettering told jurors the fraud was perpetuated primarily by Onstad and Ogier. Conti told investigators the returned money was meant to be a donation to the Blackfeet community.
Missoula County Search and Rescue pulled double duty last Friday, first being involved in the rescue of the three victims of the Mount Jumbo avalanche. No sooner had they wrapped up that effort than they got the call that two skiers were missing near the Snowball Ski Resort. Those skiers were rescued the next day. That latter event prompted the chief of search and rescue, Joshua Herbold, to write a letter reminding people of their individual responsibility for being prepared for emergencies when recreating outdoors. Herbold says although the two lost skiers did a lot of things right, which helped them survive, they weren't as prepared as they could have been.
But really, it's not about carrying the kitchen sink. You don't need everything for every possible emergency. It's taking a few basic items and having the common sense to then improvise. You know, and those skiers improvised with what they had and made the best with what they had. They might have been a little more comfortable if they had had waterproof matches or a lighter, you know, very small things that can make a big difference.
We'll have a feature interview with Herbold about how best to be prepared when recreating outdoors and about the important role search and rescue volunteers play tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
Idaho wildlife officials say it cost $30,000 to kill 23 wolves last month in northern Idaho. Idaho Fish and Game announced earlier this week the money is coming from licenses the agency sells. The agency last month said USDA Wildlife Service agents killed the wolves using a helicopter in the Lolo Elk Zone near the Montana border to improve elk survival in the area. It's the sixth time the agency has taken action to kill wolves in the Lolo Zone in the past 4 years. 48 wolves have been killed in all. The state's predator management plan calls for killing wolves when Idaho Fish and Game determines they are causing conflicts with people or domestic animals, or they're a significant factor in declining numbers of elk or deer.
Missoula lost an important voice this week when longtime Missoulian reporter Betsy Cohen died of breast cancer. The 49-year-old Cohen's byline appeared on thousands of stories in her 18-year journalism career, first as a reporter for the Butte Standard and since 1998 for the Missoulian. Cohen's work garnered numerous awards and the respect and admiration of her many peers, newsmakers, and readers. News director Sally Mock spoke this week with some of Cohen's friends and colleagues and has this remembrance.
The New York-born Cohen came to Montana after a first stint in college, working several jobs, including as a member of the ski patrol at Missoula Snow Bowl. She decided she wanted to become a reporter, and the University of Montana's journalism school is where retired professor Sharon Barrett first met Cohen.
One of the things that was really amazing about her was that she had already taken the beginning reporting class, which was the first class you had to take in order to get into the journalism program and pass it. And she had taken it with somebody else, and she had passed it, but she didn't think she had done well enough. So she wanted to take it again. And she came to me and said, I'm going to take this course again. And I said, well, you don't really need to do that. You know, it's not an easy course, and you've got a lot more to do. Well, no, she thought she needed to improve her skills before she went on with the rest of it. So she took it again, which I thought was amazing because most people would not do that. One of the things I was thinking about her, you know, she was very short, which she was very sensitive about, actually. But I was thinking that, you know, in some ways it was a kind of her height was a metaphor, her size for what she was, which was concentrated. I think of her as constant energy, concentrated courage, especially with what she's gone through in the last several years, and the concentrated tenacity, which is what I first encountered with her, which was to take the course until she got it the way she wanted it. And then she finished her bachelor's degree in journalism, and that wasn't enough, so she wanted to go for a master's degree, which she did.
like so many of us, Betsy was someone who transplanted to Montana when she was young, loved Montana, and that her love of Montana and the people of Montana always shone through her reporting.
Oh, I think there's no doubt about that. She felt totally a Montanan, and her family were from upstate New York, and that's where she was brought up. But she became really a Montanan. She was on the ski patrol at Snow Bowl. She was involved in lots of things in the community. One thing that she and I also shared in common, in addition to journalism, was we both loved horses. And we both competed in Hunter Jumper showing. And she was one of the members of the Montana Hunter Jumpers board, and she was very active in things like that. And then all the years that she worked at the Missoulian, she knew all aspects of the community because she covered the police beat, she covered the education, she covered the university. I don't think there's anything she didn't cover or didn't know about.
Current journalism professor Nadia White first met Betsy and her partner Michael Gallagher at the International Center for Journalists in Washington, D.C. White was working then as an editor at the Casper Star Tribune in Wyoming, and Cohen and Gallagher were at the Missoulian. They had each won grants to do reporting projects overseas.
Betsy had received a grant to go to North Ireland, and I had received a grant to go to Kazakhstan. And we were all in Washington to learn a little bit about international reporting. And after our week there together in this boot camp of international reporting, we looked at each other and said, we must stay friends. So even though I was in Wyoming and they were in Missoula, we made a point of connecting for the next several years until I left Wyoming and moved up here largely because they were here. You know, we really spoke the same language. We are in Washington as regional journalists talking about things that would engage our readers in the Rocky Mountains on an international scale. What stories could we go into the world and bring back? We loved those conversations. And those are the conversations that continued after I moved here. When I became a journalism professor, we talked about how do you teach that kind of inspiration? How do you teach people to listen? And that's where Betsy just had a knack. She was a very special kind of journalist.
The thing that struck me about Betsy is if you met her, you would think, oh, there's someone who's got a little bit of an edge to her. But she was one of the most compassionate journalists. She cared about everybody she wrote about.
What was stunning about her is that she could care without letting that change the story. She knew that people were people. Everyone had their warts and their wonders, and she took the time to let those express themselves in a way that was natural to her subjects. Now, if they weren't being natural or if they were withholding information, she was also absolutely dogged and was one of the tightest fact-checkers, the most persistent, dogged reporters that I know. And anyone who's ever been on that end of her reporting knows that the Betsy would out the story. So but she would take the time to hear the human inside of every story. And frankly, she was that way with her friends as well.
Betsy first worked as an unpaid intern for the Missoulian newspaper. Then after 2 years with the Butte Standard, was hired full-time at the Missoulian in 1998. Editor Sherry Devlin says Cohen worked all the news beats.
Absolutely. Over time, she covered every beat and touched every corner of our community. And really, we all benefited from her tenaciousness and her spirit and her absolute commitment to the essential nature of what we do as journalists.
One description was that she was a utility infielder, which meant she was good enough she could really cover anything.
She could cover anything, hard news, breaking news. She loved breaking news, but she was also had a really great touch with a feature story and telling the stories of people and places and their interactions in Western Montana.
I remember her features. So many of them were so moving, I thought, and really took you into where it was she was hoping to take you, I think.
I think so, too. It was really a tribute to the connection that she made with people just instantly. She was friends with just thousands of people. No one in the newsroom got as many you know, emails and cards and flowers and words of thanks from people who she had written stories about, because they really felt touched by not just the story, but by having that interaction with Betsy.
And the best journalists, Sherry, aren't they, are the ones who are the most trusted. That was what was also, I thought, stood out about Betsy. Everyone trusted her.
Absolutely. They trusted her to tell the truth, and sometimes that truth was painful for people, and sometimes it was something that really they felt like really shined a light on their own essence or the essence of a cause or a controversy that they had a deep involvement in. But certainly she was a truth teller inside the newsroom and outside the newsroom and in our community overall. We're going to miss that a lot.
And she worked really after she became ill and worked for a long time through her treatment and so on. And that was important to her, wasn't it, to continue working?
It was absolutely very, very important to her. And Betsy was determined to keep working and to keep telling those stories and to keep being the part of the newsroom, the essential part of the newsroom that she was. And we were all just fortunate to have her here as long as we were able to. Really, she stayed working until she worked in January.
It's a cliche to say someone's one of a kind and can't be replaced, but I think the cliche is true in this case.
I think so, too. You're right, Sally.
I have been speaking with Sherry Devlin, editor of the Missoulian newspaper. Sherry, thank you.
Thank you, Sally.
A fund to benefit UM journalism interns has been started in Betsy Cohen's name. Gifts can be made through the University of Montana Foundation or online at supportum.org.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 a.m. tomorrow for the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains and for elevations above 5,000 feet for the West Glacier region. Tonight, rain is likely with lows in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, rain showers are also likely with highs in the 40s to lower 50s. For Central Montana, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. Friday for elevations above 5,000 feet for the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and a slight chance of light freezing rain and snow and sleet overnight. Lows 15 to 30 degrees with wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of light freezing rain and light sleet in the morning. Rain and snow are likely through the day with highs in the 30s. For southwest Montana, tonight snow is likely in the mountains, and in the valleys there's a chance of rain and snow overnight with lows 25 to 30 degrees and wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy, and rain and snow are likely with highs in the 40s.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 44 degrees with mostly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 42 degrees. Butte has 41 degrees under cloudy skies. Great Falls is partly cloudy and windy with 42 degrees. It feels like 33. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 45 degrees. It's 46 degrees and cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 44 degrees. Libby has 44 degrees as well with cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are cloudy and it's 46 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dina Mansour.
The effort by the U.S. to broker a diplomatic meeting between Russia and the Ukraine over the Crimea confrontation fails. The United Nations blames escalating violence in Syria on world powers that have failed to act. Three Persian Gulf states pull their ambassadors from Qatar over its continued support of the Muslim Brotherhood. Each of these incidents is drawn from today's headlines, each indicating a breakdown in diplomacy. The Mansfield Center is an academic unit of the University of Montana, which entails the usual conferences, research, and academic exchange. But one thing that is special about our center is our emphasis on community engagement. This effort centers on public diplomacy, fostering people-to-people relations in a long-term approach to forestalling global crisis. While we've worked with people across the state on such critical issues as natural resources, economic empowerment, and trade, we're excited to approach new territory for the Mansfield Center, the realm of sports diplomacy. Sports diplomacy has emerged as an integral part of efforts to build relations between the U.S. and other nations. This type of diplomacy uses the universal passion for sports as a way to transcend linguistic and sociocultural differences and bring people together. Participation in sports teaches leadership, teamwork, and communication skills that help young people succeed in all areas of their lives. This year's Sochi Winter Games and Paralympic Games provide a good example of sports diplomacy. Ironically, Russia's action in the Ukraine could violate the Olympic truce to suspend hostilities during Olympic activities, just as it did during the 2008 Summer Olympics, when Georgia and Russia fought over the Georgian province of South Ossetia. Sports diplomacy is just one of many ways that the U.S. government follows U.S. law as regulated by the Fulbright-Hays Act of 1961. This act requires the U.S. government to increase mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and the people of other countries by means of educational and cultural exchange, and thus to assist in the development of peaceful relations between the United States and the other countries of the world. To fulfill this mandate, the U.S. Department of State has created the Sports United Division, which has involved thousands of people from around the world in sports exchanges. The Mansfield Center is honored to have been awarded the first Sports United grant in the state of Montana to manage an exchange between our state and China. Caught in a complicated cycle in which economic pressures have resulted in millions of left-behind youth and reduced opportunity for those with disabilities and from ethnic minority groups, youth engagement through sports is a rare opportunity for such populations in China. As a result, our project is designed to make a difference for these underserved populations. We reach out to youth by increasing the professional capacity of those who design and manage youth sports programs in China, with a focus on soccer, traditional native games, and adaptive sport for youth with disabilities. We have developed an expert team to represent Montana in traveling to China later this month. Molly Blair and Tucker Miller will represent the expertise of the University of Montana in health and human performance and wellness. Glenn Moffitt of Paxson Elementary School and Jason Shearer of the Missoula Family YMCA have daily experience working with youth of differing abilities. Leanne Dolly Powell of Special Olympics Montana will take the lead on unifying youth, regardless of ability, in affordable, inclusive sports experiences. Paul Phillips of Salish Kootenai College will draw on his expertise running native games to assist partners in resurrecting tribal games, recognizing these games' importance to cultural values, native language, health, and the overall well-being of Native families. We're honored that this team of professionals is willing to travel to China for 3 weeks to share their knowledge. In return, they'll be selecting 8 Chinese sports professionals to visit Western Montana this fall and share their skills with our community. Our namesake, Mike Mansfield, understood the value of sports diplomacy. In November 1984, as U.S. Ambassador to Japan, he invited the UM football team to Tokyo to play against Army before a crowd of 50,000 people. As the New York Times reported at the time, at the final gun, the crowd did not leave. They pressed around the fences where the players stood and reached out to shake their hands. This was the final college game for Tom Rutt, a Montana offensive tackle, and now he looked around the stadium at the crowd that would not leave and the regard with which it held the players, and said, "This is the most spectacular thing I've ever had in my life." On behalf of the Mansfield Center, I'm Dina Mansour.
Dina Mansour is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join me tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.